Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Rob Farley, and today I am delighted to have my good friend and editor, Ian Ballantyne, join us from the United Kingdom to talk about the latest revision of his book, Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom. How are you doing today, Ian?
I'm doing all right. Are you all right? Yeah.
I am doing all right. You know, like I said before, it's humid here, and I hate the humidity above all things, but I think I'll live. You and I have talked before about Bismarck. You've written extensively about Bismarck. So tell us what's new in this 80th anniversary. And we'll be releasing this podcast to coincide with the Bismarck's end, or very close to it. So tell us what's new in this new edition.
Yeah, the original book came out in 2016 and was my way of getting information, eyewitness testimony from a band of brothers, if you like, about half a dozen British veterans that I interviewed over a space of 4 years on camera for a project of mine. And I wanted to get them into print if I couldn't get them on the screen in a timely fashion. And so we did this book with Agora Books in London. And it's basically based on the transcripts of the interviews that I did, and is meant to give you as raw a feel for what happened to the human beings, the meat in the steel grinder, if you like, of the battle, and actually the last final bit before the finale, the final battle of the pursuit. So it's really from the eyewitness and human point of view. So that was the first edition, and that was very stripped back and included fresh people and fresh material that I didn't have in any previous book that I'd written on the whole Bismarck action. So when the 80th anniversary came up, I decided to supersize it and go back to it and enhance it with more on the U-boat side of it, more Germans, and also a bit more from the British side. And it's still got that kind of cinematic countdown to doom that the first one had, but it's been expanded and around 100-odd pages added to it, so it's kind of doubled. And the whole idea is to keep it moving along at a fair pace and keep it from the people point of view rather than be a battle of stats.
Right. And we'll talk about this in a second. The submarine stuff was complete stuff I was completely unaware of. I mean, I knew of the one boat that had Renown and Ark Royal in his sights and didn't have any torpedoes, but I was not aware of the effort at a submarine ambush off Greenland.
Yeah.
Or anything along those lines. So that was quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing when you go back to events that people have a certain perception of how they happened, you know, from the sinking of Hood through to the loss, through to Bismarck being sunk. It seems as if, because it was in a short space of time and it was a beginning, middle and end, that there isn't much more to find out. But every time I go back to it, I find out more about it. And having done a recent submarine warfare history as well, I was aware of where to look for certain things. And the submarine ambush idea is something that has been tried a few times in warfare since the First World War, and I don't think it's ever really worked. But they tried it again. They were going to try it again with the teaming up Bismarck and Prince Eugen with the U-boats south of Greenland and in the Bay of Biscay, but actually it didn't turn out like that. But that's one reason that they were around. And as you mentioned, U-556 was the only one to really get in contact. And unfortunately for U-556, they didn't have any torpedoes they could actually get to. So they could do nothing, as you said, when Renown and Ark Royal went by. So there's the kind of things like that will come at you out of an event that you think there's no more to be said about. Yeah.
Right. No, I thought it was in particular. You mentioned that a submarine officer was posted onto Bismarck to help out with the communications, sort of give the surface officers a perspective, a submarine perspective on exactly how to lay the best traps.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I couldn't find out his name, unfortunately. I was asked that, but I just found it in, to be honest with you, I found that in Admiral Dönitz's memoir, and he didn't give a name. But I'm sure if I looked hard enough, there probably would be a name would pop up. But that guy was put on board, obviously, to tell Admiral Lutyens and Captain Lindemann that you can't do that sort of thing because a submarine can't do it. And so the battleship officers would be educated as to what the U-boats could manage if they could link up, which was difficult in itself.
Right. I mean, when I was reading that part, the horror here, I was putting myself into the shoes of a German surface officer, and the horror of the idea of taking my battleship into submarine-infested waters and hoping that the U-boaters got it right, hoping that their silhouettes were right. And so when they opened up on what they thought was an enemy battleship, they weren't actually firing on
Yeah, business. Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm sure it's happened. But the thing about the Germans, of course, was that they were overly fond of using wireless signals. So I guess the idea was, and that was the Dönitz master plan, was that he would use radio signals to marshal everybody, you know, like chess pieces on a board. So I guess they thought they would have it all tied down. But as you say, if you get your ship spotting wrong, you can end up putting a torpedo into the wrong vessel. But it never came off, so they didn't have that mishap.
Right. I mean, that happened on the British side with the Swordfish attempting to fire upon a Royal Navy cruiser, less excusable. It feels less excusable even than a submarine.
So. Yeah, yeah. I think the problem there was that they thought the Prinz Eugen, the heavy cruiser, was still with Bismarck when they found her again. And it's that case of you see what you think you want to see. So either they thought it was Bismarck or they thought, there's the Prinz Eugen. We'll have a go at that. That ship, and they did, and it caused a lot of shaking fists on board. And fortunately, the captain of HMS Sheffield was able to comb the torpedoes, and the magnetic detonators were faulty, so they blew up before they could most of them before they could get anywhere near the Sheffield. So there was no harm done. But you're right; it was a dodgy moment and the sort of catastrophe blue on blue that can happen.
Right, right. So I've read several of your other books. I've read the Arnhem book. I've read the one of the submarine books. Is it fair to say that you've developed really a method here that's based around these first-person narratives? Because really what you're saying with Arnhem, I mean, you do describe the battle, but you are really serious about here are the people who fought it. Here is them explaining in their words. So do you feel like, is this sort of, do you now regard this as your method, your way of approaching these questions, giving this first-person account?
It dates back to the first book that I did. Well, it dates back to when I was a journalist, to be honest, when I was a reporter, because in 1990, I came down to Plymouth, which, you know, is a naval-based city. And at the time of the anniversary, the 1940 anniversary, the 50th. So there were still lots of veterans around. And in a city like Plymouth, which is home to Devonport Naval Base and the Devonport Division of the Royal Navy, which was thousands of sailors and Marines, there were a lot of veterans then. And so you could pick an event from World War II if you're a local. I became the defence reporter. So as the defence reporter, I did the modern Navy, which was much bigger than it is today as well. And I also did the World War II stuff or whatever. And so you could say the Mediterranean, for example, which is one of the most vivid early features I did, about the British cruisers being caught by the Luftwaffe during the evacuation of Crete. So there would be people locally you could go and speak to and get these amazing stories, and they were all around you. So that carried on with newspaper stories. And Arnhem, the book I did a few years ago on Arnhem, was built on a tight group of 1st Airborne Division veterans who I actually went and interviewed, sat with them for hours, one guy in particular, two people in particular, glider pilot officer and Harry Tucker, who was a corporal in the 1st Battalion, the parachute regiment. And the stories, as you sit there in their homes and you let them gently, you know, spool out what they've said and gently work round, you know, you can't ever say to people, did you kill people? Or, you know, what was it all about? You have to talk to them about the battle as a whole. And then they talk about various things and they might reveal things if they want to. But that kind of whole idea of getting people to talk, because so many of them didn't talk for 50 years. And I remember when I was doing a D-Day 50 special publication, I went around to interview a soldier from the East Yorkshire Regiment who had a battalion down here. There were lots of army people in Plymouth as well. And he went ashore on D-Day and he was shot in the knees and never made it really off the beach. They took him up the beach and laid him down to get a triage or whatever. And so that was the end of his war. And his wife was sitting in the room with us. And in 50 years, he had never told that story. And it, you know, it gives me goosebumps now to think about it. But it was amazing. So I guess I latched on to that idea that these guys who are from a different era did not talk about stuff. And I interviewed Far East prisoners of war as well, who one of whom said, after I talked to him for 3 or 4 hours, I'm afraid I don't want to see it in print. So I had to kind of consign my notebook to the bin, not the bin, but the bottom drawer. I don't know where it is now. But the point I'm trying to make, and you've latched on to, is that I felt that from a newspaper journalist, when I gathered lots of stories, and I still haven't put them all in print, I would then build on that. And so War Spite, my first book about the battleship, famous battleship, built in Plymouth, crewed originally by the Devonport Division, but, you know, a great ship with a great record, was I'm going to put the guys first. Their stories are going to come first. And so my job is to, before they're not with us, is to get them out there. So the Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom approach is even more stripped down to what they say. Although I do, with this one, of course, put more in of the context and the story. But the whole idea of the filming of them was to, A, get them on camera, and B, get their amazing stories, people other than the ones I interviewed in earlier books, and get them for history. So I thought, well, let's let people hear from them what really happened, how they really felt, and let's not purvey our kind of modern day perspective on it. Let's hear what they said. And of course, you have to know your history as well. So I've rambled on a bit there, but that's the kind of the whole motivation. It's not necessarily me showing off what I can write, although I try to write as well as I can. It's more getting their stories out there, because I think there's a lot left to learn from it.
I mean, I think it's a wonderful way to give a new perspective on events which are the basic outlines of which are extremely well known, but the ways in which people participated. Now, we mentioned this just a little bit in the pre-conversation, but the recent passing of Prince Philip, who was a battleship officer, he was on Valiant at Cape Matapan. You brought up the question of how many of these people are still around, right? I mean, that there must be very few people anywhere who are still alive, who have any memory of battleship combat. I mean, I suspect most of them are now probably from the six American battleships fought at Surigao Strait. But
yeah,
I mean, do you know of any of these folks who are still alive who?
There will be some in the UK. I mean, was one chap who was from the War Spite just a few years ago. But I mean, I was never really in contact with him, because when I wrote that book, I don't think he was in the War Spite Association, which was one of the organisations I approached for that. So he may still be with us, but I don't think there are very many, because obviously they're getting very old. And with Bismarck, if somebody wasn't 17, and quite a few of them were teenagers, the young officers and the young ratings, they had to be that age really to still be with us, to be confident that you'd find anybody. And that was in the early 2000s. So, you know, you're talking 2016 when I stopped that project, and the early 2000s to about 2008 when I did HMS Rodney, that book, and War Spite, etc. It's sad, but it's inevitable, I'm afraid. I don't think there are that many left now.
Yeah, it's just in preparation for this, I had done a quick Google search, and I found a Washington Post review of a book by a German officer. It looks like I have his name here somewhere. Baron Burkhard von Mühlenheim Reckberg, who in 1980 was still raging against Admiral Lütjens, right? That he would believe that if Lindemann had been in charge, they would have pulled out safely. So it's remarkable to me that people still feel strongly about these kinds of events, even far after them.
I'm sure, as you know, there are certain trigger battles, trigger events where people just can't stop arguing about it, and they have their own points of view. So this is one of them. There are one or two controversial elements of it, and but I think the best way to puncture the myths is to combine solid research in the museums with fresh eyewitness testimony that you can get from people who maybe haven't been talked to before because they were too junior or whatever. And the thing I found in researching some of my other books in the archives is that it went in cycles. So you mentioned the Baron there, and Ludovic Kennedy wrote a classic book as well. and a few other people. And what happened, I think, there was that that story seemed like it had been told by the early 70s or 1980 or whenever it was. But if you went back to somewhere like the National Museum of the Royal Navy in Portsmouth, which is what I did, and you looked in their archives, you could find stuff that had been recently lodged by veterans who were doing this thing where they finally decided to talk about it. And there's an amazing amount of stuff, documents and, you know, papers lodged that people hadn't looked at, because I guess in 1974 or 1980, it wasn't available. It wasn't in there. So that's the other source, is to go into the museums if you can, maybe when the pandemic's over, whatever, when you can get into them and have a sort of look through those. And I think they do turn up occasionally, though not that often. But yeah, and it can alter perspective and it can add a few controversies as well.
So let's dig in really into these final hours, and reading through this book, it hits the familiar beats. And, you know, one in particular is the damage to the rudder, that sort of at this moment we have rejoicing among the British, although there's concern about whether KGB will be able to stay with the fight, and then just the absolute despondency on the British side. So much of the story you tell is from the point of view of sailors who are on. And you also have those wonderful anecdotes about the Polish destroyer, which I certainly had never heard of before, that they're yelling in the open, "We are Poles," as they're firing.
Yeah, we're coming to get you. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the two British battleships contribute to that final fight, Rodney and King George? And Rodney was in the lead, to my recollection, in your description.
Yeah, the in the lead in the fight, yeah. I mean, the thing about the Rodney was she was, 16 years old, had a crack in her armor deck because of a bomb had hit her, but not blown, shattered. It didn't blow up, but cracked her armor deck. She had need of a rectification and a refit of her steering, her main machinery. She was badly needed a refit, and she was heading to, first of all, to Canada to drop off quite a lot of passengers. She had 500 passengers on board during the Bismarck battle, which is quite extraordinary. Also British bullion and some of the Elgin marbles all being taken to America with a convoy, so that she could go first of all to Canada, drop people off, and then go to Boston and get a refit in an American naval dockyard. And so they weren't really expecting to do much other than an escort, a troop ship called the Britannic, across the Atlantic. But when this whole thing unfolded, her captain, Frederick Dalrymple Hamilton, did an amazing, masterful read of the Admiralty Signals net and got together a group of his officers and decided to place Rodney, because he knew she was slow and it could be temperamental in her steering and her engines, but she had the biggest guns in the Royal Navy at sea, and also bigger in caliber than Bismarck's, and actually more of them, 9 16-inch. So she loitered on this track to Brest, to the French Atlantic ports, and kind of guessed where to go and stayed in that area while King George V, the new, faster, but for a moment going in the wrong direction, north, then turning around, coming south very fast, met up with her on the trail of the Bismarck. And so the two of them came down from the northwest, and Admiral Tovey decided that he would let the heavy hitter, which was Rodney, go in close and manoeuvre to basically destroy Bismarck, while the King George V stood off out of her line of fire and fired as well. And then there were the two heavy cruisers as well, Dorsetshire and Norfolk. And this was very much unlike the Battle of the Denmark Strait, in that it was all very tightly coordinated to give all the ships freedom of manoeuvre and not present this problem of, you know, only being able to present some of your guns as you raced at high speed front on towards the enemy. So there was a kind of a tag team, if you like, or an effort, a pack around Bismarck when she was crippled, her steering was crippled, and they just basically tore her to pieces. And Rodney, yeah, went in and did. When you see the track chart, and I first saw it in the Imperial War Museum, I saw the torpedo chart from the torpedo officer, a guy called Lewis, and it showed the actual track chart that he filed and how she zigzagged in and around Bismarck while she fired torpedoes as well as firing her 6-inch and 16-inch guns. And when you see that, it brings home to you the absolute devastation that that ship wrought on the Bismarck at close range. And, you know, there are obviously, as you know, and we'll probably discuss in a second, there are many debates about why she wasn't, they weren't able to sink Bismarck in the same fashion as Bismarck sank Hood. But certainly when you see Rodney's track chart and you see how she manoeuvred, it's quite a revelation as to how it really unfolded at point-blank range.
Now, by the time the battle began, I mean, the Germans had still not solved any kind of maneuverability issue. So Bismarck was unable to even tactically do any kind of maneuvers, or I mean, had they made any progress at all on that in terms of?
No, not really. They had a minimal amount of steering possible because you know, maybe somebody knows more about this, even though I've written a few books on it, will tell me different. But the way I understand it, because the screws were set outside the rudders, it meant you could not use them to steer in the way that, let's say, a British ship or other German ships, let's say, with a different design could. So the problem was they could only exert a minimal amount of force to steer her. And so if she did, the engines worked, everything worked, you know, the electricity was on throughout the whole battle, right to the end. And there was no problem with that. But it was the problem of if they tried too hard to steer with the props. And I think what they did was they just go around in a big circle. So they decided they would try and alter the course a little bit, but they couldn't really do much other than be at the mercy of, you know, the wind and the waves and, you know, and going at a certain amount of knots. And so the British found Bismarck at their mercy.
Now, you also discuss, which is something that I have only rarely seen discussed in terms of the final hunt for the Bismarck, that Bismarck was still firing when she first engaged and even later on in the battle, but her gunnery was poor. Did she land any hits on the main battleships? I may have missed this in the
account. No. It's they had some shells landed close to Rodney, and there was shrapnel inboard. And in one particular incident, a piece of shrapnel came into the air defence, very thinly armoured, in fact, not armoured at all, but thinly protected air defence position right on the top of Rodney's tower structure, command structure, if you like. And that came in there. One of the sailors foolishly picked up the hot shrapnel, got burned, learned his lesson. So that was one. And then there were a few other instances of shrapnel coming into Rodney, and a near miss jammed one of Rodney's torpedo tube shutters, as they call them. So I think only one of her tubes was then firing. And before that, she had actually landed some shells near Sheffield. And this is only the final bit. I'm not on about earlier, right. Earlier in the action. And so there were three men killed in Sheffield. So that was it. And there were no blows landed on any of the ships. And also, it's amazing, but Bismarck, contrary to the film Sink the Bismarck of the 60s, didn't shoot a single swordfish down, although they did damage them. But the swordfish, as you know, is a strange aircraft, and it was difficult to shoot down even when you hit it. But they didn't come anywhere near shooting down. They did damage swordfish, but they didn't shoot down a swordfish either. So with the exception of Hood and that amazing killer blow, Bismarck's record there was pretty poor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, her gunnery was better at Denmark straight because she also landed hits on Prince of Wales.
Yes, of course.
Some of this is ascribed to morale and the situation with Bismarck.
That's true. I mean, the key thing is they came in Denmark straight. They had an 8-minute battle. They had the enemy. The enemy made errors. You know. We've had it's a terrible event, and it's been commemorated this week. But the truth is, there were errors made, and there's lots of debate, which I don't go into in this book, about all that. But they were given an advantage in that the British fired the Prince of Wales was ordered along with Hood to fire just on Prince Eugen at the beginning of the Battle of the Denmark Strait. And as I've put in another book, the gunnery officer of Prince of Wales was desperately saying, you're firing at the wrong ship, because they look very similar, Prince Eugen and Bismarck. And so that gave the Germans a chance to concentrate fire. And then there was the whole problem of going, as Admiral Holland felt he had no choice but to go straight at Bismarck with only some of his guns bearing. So the Germans had advantages there. They're known for having superb gunnery, superb optics as well. And then a few days later, the problem was they could feel the Royal Navy was closing around them. Lütjens was a man who demoralized the Bismarck's crew with some of his addresses to them. And then they kind of, their morale collapsed the night before, as I mentioned in this book. And that, if you read, you know, you just have to read the German accounts. You know, it was collapsed. People were just lying down and waiting for their fate. They'd mentally gone. So when they saw Rodney and King George V, and they'd been harassed by destroyers all night, so they didn't get much sleep, and they felt that this was it. And they basically, first of all, their morale was collapsed. They did fire. They would have hit had they could. But the key difference was that the gunnery control and the command control was totally shredded by particularly the 8-inch guns of the cruisers, the British cruisers, and the gunfire of the British battleships. So they surrounded her, and then he just, no matter how well her hull withstood the pounding, they just took her apart. So that's why she then couldn't aim or fire, or, you know, it was just destroyed.
Yeah, you give the account of even before the Bismarck ran into serious problems, when there was still hope that she was going to make it home, Lütjens gave what is an anti-motivational speech, a demotivational speech.
Yeah.
Not be too happy or too optimistic because they weren't home yet.
Yeah, I think the problem with Lütjens, and I do have a friend and colleague who will give you different insights into this, and he has some interesting thoughts about this, and I discussed it with him recently. But the thing about Lütjens that you find when you read basically the accounts the Germans give and in general is that it seems, and even himself, it seems that he had just dodged Rodney in March 1941 when he took out another raiding sortie. And Rodney, for a variety of reasons, didn't take out the ship he was in, one of the battle cruisers. So I think when he came home, and I've put this in the book, he felt that he wasn't going to come back because he thought his luck had gone out before he even set sail. And he was saying to people, I'm not going to come back. I'm dead. So I think there was a mindset in his head, and maybe in other people's heads, that the Royal Navy was going to get them. They might get away with it for a short while, but in the end, the Royal Navy will get you. And that is exactly what happened. So, but he didn't help by, demoralizing the crew.
So can you tell us a little bit about the situation with on board Bismarck in the battle is very unusual. This is something that you alluded to earlier, because no matter how badly the fighting power of the ship was effectively destroyed, the ship itself was incredibly reluctant to sink. And so, I mean, the things we know about it, we know of the collapse of morale, we know that lots of people are hiding out in parts of the ship. What do we know about now about the scuttling charges being fired? What do we know about the effort to surrender that probably happened with part of the ship? I mean, what's going on Bismarck as it's being just hammered like no ship has been hammered before?
I think you could best compare Bismarck to like a battalion of troops that are on a battlefield, spread across a battlefield, or in town. And so if you don't have the ability to, like a radio or people running with orders or just to communicate what's happening and to let them know what's going on, and you get the command taken out and another bit's damaged, and you can't get an answer when you phone HQ and you can't send reinforcements anywhere, they're all sort of bogged down and they're pinned down. And that's what you had with Bismarck. And she was basically, they were all locked up, buttoned down, and they were left to it within their parts of the ship. The extraordinary thing is that Bismarck's engineering department, the guys down in the engineering spaces running all the machinery, had no idea what was going on with the ship. They thought, they knew the steering was gone, but I mean, other than hearing the bumps and the bangs and everything else, and occasionally they might get a bit of smoke down the ventilation, they had no idea how much the ship had been destroyed beyond the citadel that protected them and the ammunition, the magazines, the cordite and shell rooms, and basically the lower machinery of the gun turrets, the big gun turrets of 15-inch, they had no idea, those people within the well-armoured bits, that it was so bad. And it was only when they were told, right, we're abandoning ship, and especially in the engineering spaces, we're off, you know, we're going to abandon ship, we're going to set the debt, the scuttling charges, we're going, that they emerge into this hell beyond them and realized how bad it was. And so it was lots of people disconnected, and as you said, cut off and in their own little groups with no communication. And the big controversy, of course, is, you know, did the British sink her or was she scuttled? I mean, that's the thing that keeps coming up, and people try to make their own points about that, don't they?
Right. And in the end, the answer is, even if she were scuttled, it was because the British were sinking her.
Yeah. Well, they did. I mean, if you, I've got to give credit to David Means. I know Bob Ballard has looked into it and people have different points of view. But David Means is a guy I've talked to about this. And he did a very recent survey of the wreck and gave me some information for the passbook. And she was holed below the waterline with torpedo hits. And one of them could have been from Rodney. One of them could be from a swordfish that we don't know about, or a destroyer. And she did have shell holes below the waterline. So he describes her as being holed, taking in water, taking a long time to go down, but being like a boxer that's had the knockout blow and is heading for the canvas, but just hasn't quite hit it yet. When the scuttling charges, lands another punch, and that seals the knockout. And it is true that Rodney had a problem with her shells in that they were only armour-piercing. They were no high-explosive shells. So she was going in there with armour-piercing, and a lot of them were going straight through Bismarck, but a lot of them did do damage inside. And so, you know, the Dorsetshire, the cruiser, is sent in at the end when the British battleships have ceased fire and told to torpedo. In fact, all ships that have torpedoes are told to go in, but the Dorsetshire is given the job of going in and puts torpedoes into Bismarck. And at the same time, the scuttling that is set in action takes effect. And so that's it. Sinks stern first and turns over. And whoever did it, however they did it, that's the end. You know, lots of people have died and many more are going to die in the water. So it's a grim, brutal business.
Right. Could you tell us a little bit? I know we've talked about this before, but can you tell us a little bit about what we know about there being a surrender effort? And you've mentioned this in some other articles about how it would have simply been impossible to take the hulk of Bismarck.
Yeah.
Under those conditions, it would have been impossible to take the hulk of Bismarck under any kind of tow.
I mean, I when I did the book on HMS Rodney, I got their archive, what remained of their archive, from one of the key people there. And I looked through it and I found this account by the air defence officer called Lieutenant Campbell, who, because he was in air defence but was in his thing, as I mentioned earlier, right at the top of Rodney's tower, he didn't have anything to do except watch because they were merely waiting for any aircraft. Rodney did not actually have her anti-aircraft guns manned, because that would have been to condemn men to death. And so he was sat up there in this air defence position, and he saw what he thought was semaphore signals from Bismarck. After looking at Lieutenant Campbell's clue, if you like, after finding Lieutenant Campbell's suggestion of semaphore signals from a mast on Bismarck at the front end of the ship, I then got in touch with Kevin Byers, whose father, Tommy Byers, had been a rating in the level below the air defence position, in the main gunner and control position of Rodney. And he had, and the people, a lot of the people I've spoken to and featured in the book had high-powered optics, so they could really see what was going on. And he was on these high-powered optical instruments, and he saw more than that. He saw a guy using a semaphore on one of the forward turrets who was blown away, a black flag on a halyard, and that was probably blown away. And also, I think he saw light signals as well. And then beyond that, I did find a sailor in HMS Dorsetshire, and I put this in another book I did, Killing the Bismarck, A.E. Franklin, who thought he saw signals as well. So for me, and I'm not saying it's going to stand up in court or is scientific proof, but for me, it's a very intriguing proposition. And to me, it makes sense because with all the command and control gone in the fore end of the ship, the secondary armament and the main guns aft still firing, there's going to be people at the front who are thinking, you know, most of our officers are dead, although they do say that Lindemann's still alive. But, you know, things have just gone, you know, to pot. And we've had it. We're being slaughtered here. So we're going to surrender. We've got to talk. We must talk. We must stop this. But the problem was the colours were still flying. And unlike there was one other instance in history where battleships did surrender in a battle, but they were not the same circumstances. And it wasn't at close range. And I don't think the one of the sides was firing either. And there were clear signs that one of the sides wanted to surrender. So these were clues and signs, but they weren't really firm enough, I would say, for King George V and Ronnie to say, right, we're going to stop. And it's inconceivable with all that gunnery going on that you could just stop when part of an enemy ship is still firing. And as you said, you know, the idea, why would you want to, I mean, you couldn't put a tow, I mean, how would you put a tow across? And then how would you put a boarding party across? And then why would you tow the Hulk? The main thing you would want to do is get rid of it. And if you think there's 200 Luftwaffe bombers coming, and they did think that, and your fuel is running out, and there are U-boats around, you're not going to stop. But you will pick up survivors if you can. So that's what happened. But yeah, I mean, it's I guess it upsets some people to think of the mighty, invincible Bismarck surrendering. But actually, if you're a human being and you've got these massive shells of one ton and hundreds of people around you, and dozens of people in your own area have been killed, torn apart, you're not going to want to carry on, are you? You're going to want to surrender.
Well, and I think perhaps from a perspective that looks too much at both the World War I and World War II experiences, you know, in the history of maritime affairs, the history of naval warfare, surrender is understood as possible.
Yes.
You know, repeatedly in the Napoleonic Wars and so forth, like taking a ship, having it strike its colors. This is something that can happen. It's the 20th century is the anomaly here, not the previous naval history.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. So it's just an intriguing and fascinating example that helped me explain, I think, you know, the reality using what the guy said and the other research had done of what actually happened. Because to me, there was a bit of a black hole in the middle of the Bismarck action story. Because Dalrymple Hamilton, Admiral Tovey, I've never found an account by any of those people. Although I've got secondary reports of what they might have said on the bridge, et cetera, et cetera. And it always made me think that they were a little bit ashamed of the fact they had to pour fire into this ship. And they had to do it. It was their duty to do it. But it wasn't a pleasant thing to do. And, but, you know, it's the reality of what happens when these huge ships start hurling massive shells at each other.
Now, just at the very end here, can you tell us anything about what happened after Bismarck sank? So 115 are rescued. You mentioned Captain Lindemann. Did he abandon ship? Do we know anything about whether he abandoned ship and simply was not able to be picked up?
Yeah, as I put, I think in the book, there was a suggestion that he was seen with a rating, a sailor going to the fore end of the ship to up to the prow, and that he was saluting as the ship kind of turned over and fell into the sea. But the rating was this witness that was in the sea, German sailor, said that he gave permission to this rating to abandon ship. I mean, how they could really know that and whether they really saw that, I don't know. Because I think there were, three officers survived, and they were all from areas of very, I think at least two of them were from the Baron, as you mentioned, and an engineering, the engineering officer were in very well protected areas and got out. So whether or not he survived, I don't know in reality. But certainly I put in the fact that he was seen by people in the water because, you know, I'm basically reporting, although I wouldn't put in anything that I think has no merit and has no reality. I think when people are saying that he was seen saluting and went down with the ship like that, then there's a certain amount of stuff you can put in that's their perspective. But you know, they may have seen him, and it could well have happened. But you know, I decided to take it that he might well have survived.
Something that's always been interesting to me about this. Now, obviously, the Royal Navy essentially had to withdraw out of concern over the German bombers and over concern of the U-boats. A very similar thing happens when Scharnhorst is destroyed off Norway, but the circumstances there are much different, right? It's December, it's farther north. I guess that if I didn't already know the answer, I would have thought that German submarines or somebody could have picked up more survivors from Bismarck than were actually picked up. Especially because
I'm sure they were supposed
to be in the area.
So. Yeah, there were submarines in the area, and one submarine picked up three, and I've got that in the book. And a weather reporting ship was ordered to the area and picked up two, and they found an empty dinghy with nobody in it, which probably had another two or three people in it. But the problem was, you know, it's very cold water. The seas were rough. There were hundreds of them in the water. And I guess if they could have found them, and they searched for a long time, they would have picked them up. But they would have soon succumbed to hypothermia and shock, you know, and died. And some of them would have given up. If they couldn't get into a raft, there were no rafts. They couldn't get on board something. There were some dinghies and rafts and things, I'm sure, then they wouldn't stay alive for very long. And there was mention, one of the eyewitnesses, a German eyewitness in the book, Bismarck 24 Hours to Doom, who I quote in there a fair bit, said that they were told that the British would kill them and that they would get rid of them and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so some may have decided they would wait for the Germans to arrive, you know, this idea that the U-boats, as you said, could come along and pick them up. But those that, you know, maybe were a bit older, a bit more experienced or just had more faith that they wouldn't be killed by the enemy did go over to Dorsetshire. And the problem was that a lot of them were suffering from, as we say, you know, hypothermia, and they couldn't get up the ropes or they weren't listening to instructions. And then the U-boat was seen, a potential sighting of a U-boat happened. So Dorsetshire, with several hundred of her own people to look after, had to go. But they did chuck stuff over the side, floats and things. But I think it's not very easy for a U-boat, particularly if it's at the end of a patrol with low diesel and, you know, to pick up people in heavy seas. It just isn't going to happen. And the Spanish cruiser was sent to look, but I'm afraid that's the cruel sea, and that's what happens. So I'm afraid they were lost as well.
So I think we're towards the end here. I mean, I'm curious, what is the next thing that you're working on? You have another book project. I know you always have work on the MAG, Warship International Fleet Review, which I have contributed to.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And but what else do you have in the hopper in terms of the next book?
I have been working on some new, fresh material for a book I did a few years ago called HMS London. And this time it's a new end chapter on the next HMS London, which is going to be a new city class Type 26 frigate. And then I was given a midshipman's journal by one of her World War II officers, which is extraordinary, years ago. And I returned it to his family. Sadly, he passed away. And I've finally got an opportunity to put some of that stuff into the book, and it's set in the war against Japan, and he ended up being in the destroyer flotilla that went up against the Japanese cruiser Haguro in the last destroyer surface action of the war, and I was like amazed, and so I do, in essence, a chapter on him and his journey. So I've added stuff and I've put a new intro on it. We've refreshed some of the pictures. So I've been working on that as well. And that's really just an update on that. And I do have another idea, but there's more to come on Bismarck, which I can't really talk about at the moment, coming up. And so when I can talk about that, I will. I have set up a website. Can I give that a mention?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we'll put it in the post called, as well.
It's called bismarckbattle.com. And that's going to have the news of this next thing on it eventually. And that should be up this weekend, hopefully. Bismarckbattle.com. Yeah, the Bismarck action really starts on the 23rd of May when the cruisers are Suffolk and Norfolk are training her. But then the actual first action is on the 24th, as you know so well, because you wrote a really good article on HMS Hood in the current edition of Warships magazine. Yes.
All right, Ian. Well, thank you so much. This has been a delight, as it always is when we have the chance to have a conversation. LGM listeners, thank you so much. All of the links to the book and all the other material are in the post right now. So go ahead and take a look. Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Styles catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,